Heyo, and here we go. Welcome to another edition of We Talk Music. It's an extra special guest we have on today. We have on a gentleman who I think you've performed with well nigh every band, it seems, in the world. But we have Jason McMaster of Dangerous Toys, of Igniter, of, Howling Sycamore is the new one. We got Broken Teeth. I know I'm missing a bunch of other ones as well. Jason, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much for having me.
This is great, Jason. You know, I think back and for many years, James Brown was known as the hardest working man in show business. Are you trying to take that over? Are you the next generation?
No, I think that James Brown deserves that title. A lot of people, in all seriousness, see the list of irons I have in the fire. Well, a lot of the irons are, not getting hot. They are, a lot of these projects are seasonal. Some of them only play a couple of shows a year. And when I let all the air and steam out of it like that, it's a little less impressive, but I definitely, enjoy writing and recording and performing in any form of those words. So I don't know if I'm known as a whore of rock and roll, but I like to be it's nice to be asked to be involved in something new or in a couple of the bands that I'm part of, I would be the replacement singer, and a lot of people don't know, but historically, Igniter, I replaced someone, and in Dangerous Toys, I replaced someone. Actually, in Watchtower and Evil United, on the local band level that no one would know about anyway, I've also replaced someone. So, when somebody needs a singer and I'm standing there, I guess it was hard for me to say no for a long time.
Well, it's very interesting because on reading your bio on your website and stuff, I mean, obviously you've managed to say no to a few bands. I mean, it lists Pantera and Skid Row as bands that you've said no to. But yeah, I mean, even I'm not even sure we realized about the level of replacement that happened. Yeah. I mean, especially with Dangerous Toys and stuff like, because I know for us, Dangerous Toys was really where we heard of you.
Yeah, well, that's like a lot of people, and like I said, on a local level, if there was a singer just before me, maybe they hadn't hit any sort of ground yet. They weren't breaking ground yet, or they were doing something a little bit different, and the band was called something different, so you wouldn't know that. But it's interesting, that I'm standing there. If the person before me dropped the bag, I was standing there to pick it up, the thing about the Pantera Skid Row, just to make it clear for listeners, it's an honor to be asked by anyone to front their band, when they have the respect that those bands have, but those were auditions that I turned down. I didn't have the gig, just so you guys know. Mm. But just to even be honored to be thought of as somebody who could actually, that the band actually, the dudes in the band actually thought that I could, that I would be a decent replacement was, that's fucking cool. That's the only reason it's up there. I mean, why would I not want to put that in, you call it bragging and boasting and whatever you want, but why would I not want to put that on there just because it looks like an old bowling trophy to me, that those guys were, just sitting there on the shelf, but it did happen. And respectfully, everyone in those bands was there back when I was there doing something that they thought was cool. And I thought they were, you know, we were all breaking ground, you know, pretty cool. Skid Row was seriously established. Pantera was just getting going kind of thing, as far as they were losing Terry Glaze and looking for somebody. Terry Glaze ended up being in Lord Tracy.
That's right. I remember Lord Tracy.
Yeah. Yeah, he was the singer for Pantera. And then they were looking for someone new. And, you know, you got to think about what happened when they got Philip. You know, I mean, that sort of like, that changed metal, just like Metallica changed metal, just like, I don't know, Billy Gibbons changed guitar, you know. Just like Eddie Van Halen changed guitar. It's, in my opinion, it's pretty huge historically.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those cases where even though you didn't do it or whatever, I mean, certainly it worked out for the best in that case, no question.
Yeah, and I'm glad that I didn't, just for history's sake and just for what's going on. You know, Skid Row figured it out, and they're still Skid Row, and they're still a band. And, you know, Pantera is this legend. And ironically, Pantera's first major tour was supporting Skid Row.
Really? Wow. That's that's something else.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because we actually get we've gotten some early Pantera stories before, because a friend of the show, Mark Ferrari, was on, and he worked with Pantera before they became big as well. So, but
what was he doing with those guys?
Oh, he co-wrote one of the songs on Power Metal, and I think he worked with them in production a little bit.
Oh, cool. Well, that's awesome. That's something, because, you know, that was Philip's first record with them.
Yeah, that's right.
And didn't they actually ask you to join twice, though?
Both bands. They, you know, my first no, they didn't believe me or something. You know, maybe they felt like, you know, how could anyone dare turn us, you know. I don't think that was it. I just think it's funny fantasy in my head, you know. Snake Szabo called me twice. The Pantera thing, Vinny called me, and then, no, I'm sorry, it was their dad. It was Mr. Abbott.
Oh, wow.
It was Vinny and Daryl's father called me. And he was kind of managing them at the time. And he got my number from somewhere and called me. That would have been 1986. And then Vinny called me a couple of weeks later. And I was like, well, you know, I'm still in Watchtower, and I'm trying to get this thing off the ground still. And, you know. And the ironic thing is, it wasn't long after that that I ended up working with Dangerous Toys, and that, you know, no one knew what that was. And that would have been October of 87. And let's see. 6 months later, I was leaving Watchtower for a cock rock band. And Pantera was a cock rock band getting a singer, turning into a thrash band. So I was going from thrash into more of a rock and roll, and they were coming from a rock and roll into a thrash, you know. So it was pretty strange, that Pantera turn of events. But yeah, the Snake called me 2 weeks after the first call, after I turned that down. And that would have been 94.
Wow. Yes. Okay.
He called me the second time. He goes, "Are you sure?"
All those years later. That's nice.
Yeah, but him and Rachel and I have totally, of course, non-sexual man crush. You know, I have a lot of respect for both of those guys. And I mean, they know how to write kick-ass rock and roll songs. So anyone who knows how to do that is all right. You know, it's kind of a power that people have. It's easy to write crappy songs. Those guys don't write crappy songs.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I mean, one thing that I can say is that from listening to you and all the variety of bands, you would have fit very well with any of those bands. That's for sure. I mean, your work.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm very metal, and the people that only know me from Toys and refuse to go past that, that's fine. But, you know, I write Christmas music, you know, I love the blues. There's some old storyteller stuff, you know, Cash and Dylan and Willie Nelson and stuff like that, that I think is, if you can tell a story with any kind of music, I think that music has validity. So that's kind of where I am as a musician and a music fan before all. So, you know, it's good to have that recognized by people sometimes.
Is that, I mean, Dangerous Toys, obviously you've said, you know, never say never, but I mean, no new album coming, no new songs. Is that kind of the thing that's the cock rock band, and it's tough to go back musically to writing those type of songs when you kind of moved on in some way?
Well, I think that this kind of goes without saying, but being in your 50s, writing songs about your cock is different than when you're in your 20s writing songs about your cock. So it's however comfortable you are and what kind of adult you've become, I guess. But, you know, no one's grading anybody here, you know. If rock and roll is supposed to be dangerous, or it's not rock and roll. So if it's dangerous to write songs about your cock when you're in your 20s or your 50s, it doesn't matter. So I think that just writing a good song that fits the barrel of the gun you're holding at the time in your career, or whatever it is that you feel like you belong to, I think that you stay as true and as comfortable as you can. To give a real answer, you know, Dangerous Toys writing a new record, it's being talked about right now, and we're actually dabbling with writing new material. It feels even weird to say that, because last time that we actually wrote as a band would have been in 1995.
Yeah, so that's insane weird. When you think about that, 20, almost, you know, 22, 23 years later. But, I mean, you know, obviously, like we say, we, you know, listen to a lot of your different stuff, but, you know, going back to that band and listening to them, you know, fresh for the interview, it's, I mean, the music is great, right? And so, I mean, as fans of that and fans of what you did, you know, hearing that is, it's, I mean, it feels good for us, and I'm sure it would feel good to everybody. Because, I mean, the fans are really loyal to that band. I mean, I'm sure that's part of what would drive you guys to do it, is just, you know, want to reward those fans that have been with you all those years.
Yeah, but you have, you know, you can't do it just for, I love what you're saying, and you're not wrong, but you can't, I mean, I'm the one that's got to sing it. If I'm going to sing it half-heart, you know, half-assed, you can't do it.
True.
If I think numbers and I'm, say, a band manager or the bean counter or something, or the treasurer, and I look at, well, is it going to make us any money? Are you guys going to, you know, be able to pay rent by, you know, taking off work to go make a record? Are you going to lose money if you do it? Yes, you are. See what I'm trying to say?
So, oh, yeah.
And no, it's not going to sell the numbers that are expected, even by a loyal fan base that thinks you're the cat's meow. Just because you have a loyal fan base doesn't mean that you're going to sell, you know, even a few thousand copies of your record, believe it or not. The reissued Pissed, Dangerous Toys Pissed on vinyl for the very, very first time just over the past few months. I don't know if you knew that already or not, but you can get it on colored vinyl. You can get it on picture disc. And it never came out on vinyl in 94 when it came out. And the label is shocked. Well, I'm not so shocked, but the label is shocked that, you know, the 500 of each of those reissues are sitting on a shelf. No one's buying it.
Yeah,
it's its own animal. But you would think, okay, 1,000 copies of a Dangerous Toys record can't sell 1,000 copies of Pissed on vinyl. in we're a gold, you know, twice gold selling band, you know, over a period of about 4 or 5 releases, we've sold over 1 million records. Now, by industry standards, that might be kind of small. By some industry sort of standards, we are still a charting, you know, sure, we're sort of a has-been, but we're still a charting gold-selling band that can't sell 1,000 copies of a record that never came out on vinyl. You know, it's ridiculous. And we're not crying over spilt milk at all. But it's just an interesting way to look at things. So we're more excited than the fan base is to have that record on vinyl finally.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unfortunate, and I think almost, you know, maybe for the fans, it comes down to the ability to see you live, because I know for us, like, we never had a chance to see you guys live, and I mean, being in Canada certainly hurt us in that regard, but I think that's the biggest concept, is the ability to see you live. So I mean, you know, good for the Monsters of Rock crews to have you guys and stuff like that.
Yeah, and any festival that might ring us up, and once again, this is the dirty sort of underbelly of the whole thing. The festival, the crews, whoever, the buyer. You know, we can't afford to lose money going just to play live. I mean, just to satisfy the fan or even our egos or whatever the hell it is that we're trying to do. Why we keep this up, you know, is there's a lot of reasons why we would want to. It's part of who we are. It never goes away. It's an itch that needs to be scratched. We love rock and roll. We love our fans. There's, you know, it's as long as my arm, you know, the reasons why to do it. But if we can't do it for free, you know, we can't, like, we all have jobs. We're trying to, you know, pay a mortgage and feed our families, and, you know, to take a chunk out of the everyday being able to take care of ourselves. You know, it's kind of a bummer to say that, but numbers got to match up for us to even leave the house. And a lot of fans don't want to hear about that. They just want to see the band live. And a lot of people, if they missed us, like you guys kind of missed the boat on seeing us live, that's what all of this stuff is good for. There's also, and this is kind of something that I sort of cherish, is that when the fans have kids that are now 17 to 20-year-olds, and they grew up with our music because their fans, their parents played it on the stereo all the fucking time, and they've grown to, you know, oh man, yeah, that's part of my growing up. And I'm like, how old are you? Oh, I'm 19. That's fucking great, man.
Yeah,
that's cool. And if they like this kind of butt rock or whatever you want to call it, you know, but they're wearing a Slayer shirt, you know, they're wearing a Slipknot shirt, or they're wearing a Mushroom head shirt, or they're whatever, you know, I can't even name you a new metal band. I don't know any, but my point is the same. It's like this family, this lineage, if I say hand me down, it sounds shitty, but it's a hand me down. It's like, no, man, I dig that because, you know, my brothers, my older brothers or my mom or whatever totally turned me on to this shit. And so it's part of, you know, I dig it. It's cool, man. This is one of the first songs first album my mom ever got me was Hellacious Acres. And then you think like that, it's like pretty cool. One of the guys in, have you heard of his band, Scorpion Child?
No,
I can't say that I have.
They have a record on so, and anyway, they're from here in Austin, Texas, and I was sitting having coffee or whatever with the singer, and you know, I think we were just at a show hanging out, having coffee is metaphor, and he was like, dude, the very first cassette tape my mom ever got me was Dangerous Toys, Hellacious Acres, and just hearing that, you know, I was like, wow, okay, well, even if I wasn't even in the band and I was just a fan of that, that would be really cool. That would be something to just hear and go, right on, well, your mom fucking liked kick ass, you know, if I was just a fan of that, you know. Just even hearing that at my age was awesome. It wasn't like, oh, shit, I'm sorry. Well, maybe a little bit.
That's awesome. No, I mean, it's the butterfly effect. Maybe you're probably not thinking about it. I'm sure you're not thinking about it all those years ago. But, yeah, I mean, you know, you make this music, you influence the next generation of musicians, even if it's just one band. That's like, incredibly awesome.
Yeah, the same, not to tell the same war stories over and over, which is what old man... me and my wife were sitting watching that metal show, and this would have been probably a couple years ago, and we're watching that metal show, and it was a new episode at the time, and this guy Matt Nathanson, do you know who that is?
No.
Why was someone named Matt Nathanson that the three of us don't who know who the hell he is on that metal show? Well, I'm about to tell you. So me and my wife sitting there watching that metal show. Eddie Trunk walks out. Today, our guest is Matt Nathanson. Everyone's like, well, what's a Matt Nathanson? You know? So, you know, and so he comes out and blah, 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 and he's sitting there and he's, you know, he doesn't look really out of place at all. He just looks like a rock and roll guy, and he's sitting there. And they start off with, so a lot of people don't know who you are in our crowd and our audience and our, you know, people at home. And why don't we, you know, start this up and I'll just get it going. So on the Tonight Show, you went on and you performed your new song, and it was a great performance, but we were all sitting at home with our families watching the Tonight Show, and we see this guy, Matt Nathanson, wearing a That Metal Show t-shirt on the fucking Tonight Show. Okay? So we look up Matt Nathanson. It's this kind of pop little singer-songwriter pop guy, right, wearing a That Metal Show t-shirt. And you have to think about how many millions and millions of people all over, well, just start in America, but you know, people who might watch the Tonight Show overseas too, it's millions and millions and millions of people watching. So that's really good for That Metal Show. It's the best PR that you can't buy. So people are seeing that t-shirt, and so it's like, well, man, that's fucking, oh, this is super nerd shit here. Let's talk to this guy. So he comes on the show and they're telling the story, and he's like, this guy, Matt Nathanson, me and my wife are kind of paying attention. I don't know who this guy is, but they're telling the story and we're just watching. And the first fucking thing out of this guy, Matt Nathanson's mouth is, yeah, you know, a lot of people don't know that a guy like me, kind of, you know, singer-songwriter guy, would think that like the second album, Hellacious Acres by Dangerous Toys, is one of the coolest records out there in rock and roll. And me and my wife, you know, this is on national television. Me and my wife, can you rewind that? Did I just dream that? So, of course, I was instantly a fan of this person, Matt Nathanson.
Yeah, check.
But that's how that kind of shit, you know, when you think like that, it's like that's that butterfly effect again.
Yeah, that's super cool. Yeah, no doubt. No doubt, right? I mean, everybody wants to think that they're leaving a legacy. And it's right there. It's out there for people.
Yeah.
You know?
That's
really awesome. The business of music, it's changed so much then. You know, I mean, you talk about the different bands you're in and everything of, you know, and the streaming services and just the, you know, I mean, they're not playing videos really much anymore. The way you reach the fans and all that stuff has changed so much. Have you kind of wrapped your head around the modern age of distribution and you know, just kind of the modern music industry, and any thoughts about the changes?
Well, the young generation now, I teach music. That's my gig now. And I've been doing it for 13 years, and I've seen 8-year-olds come in, you know, 10, 12, 13 years ago. And now they're, you know, 20 or something. And you think about when they come in and you know, they don't know, and they don't care. They don't, you know, what, you can make money playing music. You know, they don't know that it's a business. And when you think back about, you know, when I started playing music to make money, I was playing music because of the way that it made me feel inside. Just like an 8-year-old, you know, learning how to play a guitar because of the way that it made them feel inside. Just like when they listen to a rock and roll song that they love, it's the way that you make it, it's an emotional value. That's all that it is. So to create that vibration, like literally, in every sense of the word, that's why we are doing this. That's why we are talking about this today. It's because of the way that it makes us feel inside, not because it's going to make us rich or that we can pay our rent or, you know, those mundane things that are mundane when you compare it to the emotional value that music has. So after saying that, and these new generations, you know, 10 years ago, the ones today, you know, the 8-year-olds that I work with today, just like the teenagers that I work with today, I still think that they feel like music could be free, because a lot of them, their parents are paying all their bills. You know, if they have an iTunes account or whatever, they're not having to go to clock in at Starbucks so they can pay their phone bill, their iTunes bill. You know, something comes out, they download it or whatever. They don't go to a fucking record store. That's a generational thing. So what do I do to change that? What can I do? Nothing. I try to educate them as to why and what and how, and, you know, try not to use Spotify because they only pay pennies on the dollar of what an artist deserves. You know, it's someone's, you know, it's someone's perk that you are stealing, and they don't want to hear about that. They don't get it. They don't feel the way that someone who writes a song feels about it when you turn that, when you put on the hat that says bean counter or treasurer on it, when you're managing your own affairs as a songwriter. You know, they don't know you as that. They don't want to talk to you about that, you know, especially when they're a young fan of what it is that you do. They don't want to talk to you about how broke you are. So, you know, it's the industry has changed, just like you said, and not necessarily for the better, But, you know, you don't just like home and become a garbage man, you know. You would do that. You would do that if you knew how much a garbage man made per year. They fucking tank. They do very, very well. They make more than a fucking musician does sometimes, I'll tell you that.
So, do you handle, like, most of the business affairs for the bands that you're in at this point now?
You know, it's turned into a DIY world when you are not completely established as, you know, I'm not a super multi-platinum rock star like some people kind of think. That I have multiple houses and cars and shit like that. No, man, I people say, dude, you made it, you're rock star. No, I barely made a scratch and was lucky to be in the right place at the right time and have a couple of songs push a record to gold, but that doesn't mean I have money in the bank because of it. I've got a bowling trophy on the shelf by way of a gold sales award, and that's all I've got. I call it my diploma, you know, because I quit school to play rock and roll because I love rock and roll so much. My parents were upset with me. My record went gold. I didn't know it was going to go gold. I was dumb, young rock and roll person. I didn't give a shit about anything other than making good songs that made me feel good. And what? You want to put me on MTV? Wow, that's pretty cool. All right, cool. Let's go. Let's have fun. Next thing you know, the record goes gold. And it was a time for me to have a come to Jesus with my parents who were mad at me for quitting high school. And then, you know, handful of years later, well, here's my diploma. What do you mean, diploma? Well, my record went gold. They were like, what does that mean? You know, so that's kind of a family story there about how proud of my, you know, proud parents can get when you follow a dream, because they worked their ass off so I could follow a dream, you know. So now it's come full circle with me teaching, not to get out of hand here, but the business side of the bands that I'm in or work with or whatever, there's usually someone in a group of four or five people that wear a couple of hats. And, you know, in Igniter, there's a couple of us that wear different hats, like Robert and Pat will be on the PR side of things, but I'm the guy that talks to the label, or I might be the guy that books the shows and works out how much we're going to get paid or whatever. And that hat that I just described that I wear in Igniter, I might wear their hats as well in Broken Teeth, you know, as to where someone else in any of the bands will, and it's usually the guitar player, will be the producer and the co-writer and the, you know, have a studio. Like the guitar player in Igniter, the guitar player in Broken Teeth, the guitar player in Howling Sycamore, the guitar player in blah, 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 blah. They're the co-writer, they're the producer, they're wearing a huge hat, which by way of being the producer, meaning that they own the studio or will basically produce the record, saying I'm just writing songs and cutting my vocal tracks and then walking away and waiting for the record to come out. So that's kind of how that goes. That was a good question, by the way.
Well, you know, for us, we, you know, I mean, besides being fans, we are really interested in the workings, and just because I mean, we grew up listening, but, and I mean, for all intents and purposes, we care about you guys. I mean, frankly, I like to know how you're doing. I like to know that you're going out there and you know, being able to make a living or try to at least doing what you love to do. And I appreciate the fact that you are still doing it your way.
Yeah, sure, you always wish that it would be, there was more, you know, there was more fruit on the tree, but you have to kind of, can't look the gift horse in the mouth sort of proverb. If the phone's ringing at all, if two dudes want to call you at 8 o'clock in the morning and talk about what you've done, what you've got coming up and all that stuff, consider yourself lucky. It's when those two dudes don't want to call you. They're not interested in calling you at 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, that's when you got to work.
Mm-hmm.
Is when those guys are not calling you at all anymore. Yeah, that's pretty important, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
When the phone stops ringing. Yeah, when the phone stops ringing, you're kind of screwed. So, I feel lucky.
Well, all right. Let's I have a question here, kind of based on your saying that you're teaching, and so I assume, are you teaching vocals as well, or guitar, or what do you teach?
Well, I work for a corporate company called the School of Rock, and they've been around for a long time now. It started in Philadelphia by a guy named Paul Green, and this was pre-Jack Black movie. just kind of blew up in this guy's face, and it's about this guy, Paul Green, in Philadelphia, who turned an old brownstone into a rock school. And I think it was in a bad part of town, and the rent was cheap and blah, 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 blah. It broke ground, and he franchised and became huge. And fast forward, he, in the middle of it all, he sold all his shares. I mean, this was about 17 years ago or something when this happened. So it's been a corporate school since. There's over 100 schools worldwide. And when they opened one in Austin 13 years ago, a friend of mine who lives here in Austin, who is a fellow musician, and we've done hundreds of gigs together, et cetera, his name is Rick Carney. When he called me and told me that he was starting up a corporate school, it was going to be funded by the corporate, the main office, and that he was going to be the music director, and he was looking for, and he wanted me to be the vocal coach. And I said, hell yeah, that sounds amazing. That would have been in 2005. And I've been doing it ever since. First, I was just teaching vocals, and then it graduated into basic guitar and bass guitar. And I've even been known to give a basic drum lesson once in a while, too. So wow. Fundamentals of that have also made me a better musician, just from being around it all the time. That's just how it works, you know. So, I teach a lot of guitar now, but I probably teach as much guitar as I do vocals.
Well,
now the vocals, the reason I'm kind of curious is because we were talking to Brian Vollmer of Helix, and he was talking about how when he was young, he was just singing. He didn't really know how to protect his voice and use his voice. And how about you? I mean, after 3 decades, like, do you, as a singer, do you respect it as a tool a little more, or how do you approach it?
Well, it's the same with Brian. You know, it's when you're a young person and you're just emulating your favorite singers, you know, you're not even thinking about it. You're just getting out there and doing it, and you're just got a hard on that you're even doing it. you and your band are, you know, starting a song together and ending a song together. That's a good day. It doesn't, how you're, the science of singing is not on your mind at all when you're a young teenager. You don't give a shit about much. So you're kind of bulletproof too, very resilient, you know. You probably thought it was cool and go to school the next day and brag, oh, I lost my voice last night singing Judas Priest, man. It feels awesome. You know, you don't even care, you know. So fast forward to now and the having to having no training whatsoever, and now I am a vocal coach, that throws a spin on the story as well, because I had to create a style of teaching, and I had to come up with a science behind the do's and the don'ts of what it is to be a singer. I had to learn some music theory that and apply it in a way that made sense to music, the teaching of music anyway, you know, major scale, minor scale, different ways to hold your mouth when you sing, that you can't sing through closed teeth, that you have to basically have a horse mouth when you're singing. You have to, you know, chew your words. You have to have a vernacular. There's got to be a character when you're singing. And, you know, you can't just, you know, you see, you know, some of the greats, some of the earliest extreme vocalists, such as like Rob Halford or Bon Scott, Brian Johnson, you know, AC/DC, Judas Priest, you could just stop right there with, they sound like they're murdering themselves when they sing. But obviously they're not. They're probably singing as loud as I'm talking right now. But the way that they've learned how to use their range and hold their mouth as they do it, they can hit any note that they need to hit, whether it be high, low. They're just notes. I can't sing that. That's too high. Oh, I can't sing that. That's too low. That's not a two-way street. That's a one-way street. It's high, low. Doesn't matter. It doesn't make any fucking difference. It's the science. It's like, if I sing high, does that mean I have to scream? Shit, no. Are you going to scream 3 hours every night for your gig, you know, and by way of Rob Halford and Judas Priest? No. You're going to carefully find the right amount of air and control yourself so you can do it every night for 3 hours. It's not just screaming. You're not screaming. What happens when you scream? You throw your voice out. What happens if you're warming up and you throw the ball too hard in baseball practice? You're out of the game. So there's a science behind it all. And, you know, not to turn this into a workshop, but, you know, I had to figure all that out on my own as I grew into a professional. I can just say it sounds weird me saying that, but yeah, you get it, right? You understand what I'm trying to say? It's like any business that you're in. If you are considered by your peers and your coworkers as a member of the team, you're on the team for your pedigree, and that's why I'm there. And you know, I have figured out a way to explain this to adults and kids and everyone in between, of how you should be using your voice and how to get it to sound cool and how to get it to sound this. It's like people who do voiceovers or cartoon voice, you know, cartoon characters and stuff like that. It's the same science. You know, do you guys do cartoon voices? Rock and roll singing is exactly the same. You know, do you guys have kids? You gotta talk to your kids in funny voices. You know, it's the same fucking thing. So yeah. You have to know what it is that you're doing to manipulate your throat and the muscles and your tongue and your teeth and the way you hold your jaw and all that stuff in order to get a cartoon voice or a rock and roll voice and to be able to, what notes, you know, to write a melody. It's the same, to control what it is that you're doing.
That's awesome.
Now I want to go to Texas for a music lesson, but
yeah.
So
well, good. I sold it to you. My boss would be proud.
There you go. I'm also really interested because, you know, being in, you know, singing with a number of bands that you do, and you know, playing different concerts with different bands, is there a trick then to keeping all the music straight? Because you might, like, how many songs could you even, you know, perform, you know, like on a moment's notice? I mean, I would think it must be quite a few.
Yeah, my memory is not as good as it used to be. Even songs I wrote, sometimes I can't remember the words. So, and it's because of what you described. You know, you gave me a pit to fall in by setting all that up, because there's so much there's so much going on, and you know, like the Howling Sycamore record, you know, I didn't write any of the material. I wrote the melodies, and I got to pretty much, I was a free for all to do whatever I wanted to do with the material. And so, you know, kind of, since I didn't write that stuff, it's harder for me to recall that, you know. Like, in other words, I didn't really have to learn the material for a performance. It was, here's the lyrics and here's the songs, and you sing wherever and whenever you want that makes sense. That was sort of the fun part. You know, I got to do the fun part. I didn't have to do the work. Nice. Well, not that, you know what I mean. Writing a melody is the fun part. It's still work because it can't suck, you know. But you know, writing lyrics is fucking hard. And I didn't have to do that. David Tiso of Howling Sycamore, he delivered a record's worth of lyrics and songs for me to work with, and I just went to town on it, and I don't have to remember any of it. The thing is the record came out so good, and I'm extremely proud of it. There are bits and pieces of it I can't get out of my head even right now. So,
are there any lyrics then that you've written where you thought, shit, that's good, like you're especially proud of? What are the lyrics, not even a full song necessarily, or the melody, but just the lyrics where you're like, yeah, that's really cool?
Well, it's like your kids, you know, you're going to be proud of your kids no matter what. And you know, you write a song and you feel strongly about it. Doesn't mean that it's your best work. You're just proud of it because it's new.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a guilty. I think everybody gets guilty, you know, it's like, new record. It's my, which out of all your, which is your, my new one, my latest one. That's my thing. You know, the fan. It goes, you know, you want to be excited about it, so people go buy it. You want to be excited about it because it's new. You want to be excited about it because, you know, it's a new era in your world and things like that. Like, you know, you go buy a new car because you wrecked your old one. Do you just fall in love with your new car, or do you kind of miss your old one? See what I mean?
It's fun then to ask about the experimentation.
Kind of weird.
Igniter album.
So.
Brett was, we're here. Sorry, we're just setting up our next question between each other here, trying not to step on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And Brett was just mentioning to me this morning that he's listening to the new songs on upcoming from Igniter, and that
Well, the Howling Sycamore was what I had listened to last night.
Howling Sycamore, yeah.
Yeah, and they're definitely, I mean, they're really inventive, and in fact, the first one that I listened to, it was almost even surprising that it was you singing. I mean, I know what you can do, but man, yeah, so it's very all over the map.
Kind of experimental, I think is what you were saying.
Yeah.
It's closer to, it's probably closer to what I was doing as a young man in Watchtower musically. It's very over the top, progressive, sort of pioneering a new path. Watchtower being arguably, I have to say that word, pioneer in progressive thrash metal kind of thing. And so, somewhere with that part of my career mixed with maybe something like Evil United, where it's also kind of classic riffing, but the tuning is really low, like a sort of modern, classic modern sort of thrash power metal kind of shit. And the Howling Sycamore is somewhere in between this sort of esoteric art metal mixed with, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, people can hear me and say, well, this Jason obviously plays Rob Halford in a Judas Priest tribute band, you know, and, I don't mind wearing that right on my sleeve.
Well, I've seen what you're wearing when you're singing as Rob Halford. You don't mind wearing it. I don't think I'd look good in it.
Well, no, I don't mind dressing up like the village people at all. So the you know, the Howling Sycamore is different, the cool thing is it totally did let me, David let me just kind of go for it. And like I said, I felt like I was freed up a little bit because I didn't have to worry about if the lyrics were any good. It was someone else's vision, and I had to create characters that fit the vision that these other people had. So that was kind of fun. It was like acting in a movie, right? An actor doesn't write the movie all the time, you know, unless you're Tom Hanks or something. But so, you know, it was very cool. I have high hopes for the record. You know, I hope people enjoy the journey that it takes you on. And if you're looking for Tees and Pleasin' or Sportin' a Woody, you're not going to find it.
I do have to say that I love the t-shirt. Like, the merchandise for Howling Sycamore looks great.
Yeah, I didn't have anything to do with that, but thank you. I wish I had one. I think there's a package arriving, and there might be a t-shirt in there for me, because I think David asked me what size I wear. So
that's cool. Actually, I was going to ask a question about Watchtower, but that brings up a perfect thing to bring up here. Up on Brett's wall. Brett, why don't you tell them what you got here?
That's true. Way back in 1995, I was lucky enough to get one of the Yuletide Hell by Tommy Pons, and it's signed by him and by you. And that has been up on my wall pretty much ever since 1995. But
wow. Well, those are cool. That's a great... That's a great piece of art. I don't have one.
So. Well, he'll sell it to you for a couple thousand bucks.
Yeah. Put it on your eBay store. Yeah, I'll buy it.
Tommy Pons, did you meet him yourself and bring him in? Like, how did he come to do the artwork for those Dangerous Toys albums? Because he's freaking amazing.
Yeah, I like the question. It kind of goes like this. He's from San Antonio, and Watchtower started playing in the early 80s. Watchtower started playing probably about 83 or 84. Watchtower started playing shows in San Antonio with a bunch of, because they had a cool budding heavy metal scene there. And it was still real new in Austin, and I would say that it was fairly new in San Antonio. It was a lot of bands, and we started playing with a lot of San Antonio bands. And Tommy Pons was just in the scene there. You know, he would pop up at all the shows, whether I was on the bill or not. And so we've known each other since we were teenagers. And he used to draw flyers for a lot of the bands and logos, and he would work with local promoters and do the flyer artwork, you know, Summer Holocaust, you know, and there's this big mushroom cloud with skulls all over it, you know, very 80s and very early, you know, apocalyptic metal kind of artwork that we all loved about that era of the dam breaking and, you know, Anthrax was a new band. You know what I mean? It was that kind of vibe, you know. When Metal Blade Records, you know, long-haired, pimply geeks would go to the record store and buy just anything on Metal Blade Records. I loved that.
Yeah.
That was us, yeah.
I actually still have early Metal Blade cassettes.
Oh, that's awesome. I have the first three Metal Massacre compilation records, original pressing.
That is sweet.
Yeah, those are worth money.
Yeah, for sure.
So anyways, I don't know how much. I probably couldn't buy a car, but they're by standards.
You can trade them for what Brett has on his wall here.
Yep, well, no trade.
Anyways, you were saying, anyway,
Pons was around that scene, and that's how I knew him. And the story about how he became the Dangerous Toys artist is an interesting one. I was, you know, Dangerous Toys, we were still this very, very new band, and here we are with a label and a manager, and we're trying to come up with concept. What the hell is a dangerous toy? Well, I can think of quite a few things, but for something that's not pornographic, let's think of something that we can actually use on an album cover. And I thought of, well, what about, and it worked with the song Scared. You know, it's like a jack in the box. You know, you here's a box, it has a crank on it. What do I do? Oh, I'm going to, you know, a kid walks up and he sees a crank and starts cranking on this crank. And, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. What could possibly, you know, bang, 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 ha, 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 you know, got you, spooked you. And what does the kid do? He shoves the head back down into the box and puts the clasp on, and he starts to crank it again. And I thought that's like, you know, sort of how human beings are. It's like, you know, masturbation. You know, you like what that is. So you're going to go do it, you know, again and again. It's like,
I feel like you've been looking at me.
you go see a scary movie. Well, okay, I'm now a horror movie fan. So but hold on, that scared the shit out of you. Why would you want to do that to yourself? Which led me to write the song Scared, just this whole concept of what it is we're talking about, the human psyche and why we are creatures of habit, even if it's dangerous. So you see where all this is going.
Yeah, yeah.
It fit the name of the band. It fit the Jack in the Box. It fit the one of the songs that we still play. It fit everything. So I'm on the phone with my manager, and he had faxed some doodles that supposedly the greatest art company in Los Angeles, Hollywood, California, the greatest, you know, creators of of commercial art and music industry by standards, they're sending me these cartoon bubble-headed drawings of these clowns, and they had sharp teeth and they had googly eyes and they had they had bent down brows, and they looked a little bit menacing, but they were just too round and bubbly, and they were wearing cute little cowboy hats or something. They're trying to tie it into Texas, right? And they're trying to draw this sort of clown jack-in-the-box thing. And I'm on the phone with my manager. I said, well, I got these faxes, and I don't know, man. I don't know about these. I haven't even shown them to the band yet, and I don't know about these, man. And he's like, Jason, this is the best artist in Los Angeles. This is what we've got, and this is who we're going to go with. And, you know, it's kind of the beginning of an eat shit moment with, you know, rock management. It's like, well, I'm going to stand my ground here and tell you that I've got a guy who lives an hour away from here that can blow this away with the first try. And he's like, I don't believe you. There's no fucking way. These guys are the best, and they make, you know, thousands of dollars, and these guys are great. And he was fighting me on it. I said, give me a chance. I hung up the phone. I called Tommy Pond. I go, hey, man. He's like, wow, what are you calling me for? I said, well, I got a gig for you. I need you to draw. And I told him the concept. A couple days later, I'm faxing this. I said, you know what? I don't even need to see it. I don't even think he fucking sent it to me. I think he faxed it. I think he just drew that clown and faxed it to my manager. My manager called me. He goes, you're right. You were right. Yeah. We got to go with this guy. I fucking told you. I said, was it cool? He goes, what do you mean? I go, I haven't even seen it. I just told the guy the concept and told him to fax it to you. He thought that was crazy. I said, well, you know, and my manager trusted me a little bit after that.
Yeah.
And I had known him for 3 weeks, you know.
Wow, that's awesome, because, yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite covers ever. You know, the first Dangerous Toys album. Like, so that story's great.
Should not be a secret or hard to figure out that Tommy Pons practiced drawing Eddie from Iron Maiden, and then when I called him, he just put clown makeup on him.
Yeah. You know, now that you mention that,
I think I think the guys in Iron Maiden figured that out real fucking quick, too.
Really?
Well, you know, I wouldn't know that, but if I walk in and go, dude, I'm the guy from Dangerous Toys. How you doing? I'm a big fan. It's like, yeah, you're a fan of Eddie, too, except clowns.
Now that you put that out.
But, you know, whatever. I'm not on their radar. I'm just, you know, fantasizing here that they would even give a shit.
So what about some of the bands? I mean, we've had a couple guys we've interviewed tell us that Dangerous Toys is one of the best bands to have been on the road with, like one of the funnest bands. So what about it? Do you take pride in that? Do you hear that people love touring with you, or anybody that you thought, I mean, that guy is a great guy, love touring with?
First off, who told you these lies?
Let's see, Pat Mazingo of
Junkyard.
Junkyard, yeah. Was one.
Derek?
Derek, yeah, I think Derek David. No, no, Stacy Blades. Was he? Did he? I don't know. Interviewed a lot
Stacy
of
Stacy Blades. Stacy Blades is an underrated great guitar player.
He is. Yeah.
And I don't know him as well as I probably know Pat, but.
Yeah, there was a couple of guys. We've interviewed a lot of people.
I'm glad to have gotten good reviews from our peers, and I feel like, you know, for a bunch of guys from Texas who grew up with, you know, just, you know, very standard, happy childhoods, lower middle class, working families, to not have much, to be able to just go live a dream. You cherish that, and it's fleeting moments. You don't know how long it's going to last. So you don't, you know, drink all the beer and become an idiot and because you might end tomorrow, but you cherish it. You stay awake long enough to try to figure it out and enjoy it the most. And I was a kid in a candy store when I was on the road for so many years. But I learned a lot. You know, you can't stay up all night, but you're restless and you're anxious when you're young and you're on tour and you're playing with your idols and if your first concert was in the arena and you're on an arena tour supporting someone, it's hard to keep your wits about you because you're fucking excited because you're there. You're doing what you've dreamt about. But the thing is you need to be able to adapt to the industry if you're in this for the long haul. And when you think about what, you know, if you didn't have a multi-platinum record your first time out, it's going to be hard to maintain or have any prolonged career unless you're going to wear the costume of trend. And if you play dirty rock and roll, you're not going to be in the arenas or the sheds or the, you know, you're going to go back to the clubs if you play dirty rock and roll. So, you know, when the Seattle movement came and it kind of knocked a lot of people out of their seat a little bit, you have to be proud of what it is that got you there in the first place, whether you're being knocked down or not. So there was a little bit of that going on with the reality when that all turned, and you cherish those moments that you had when you were on the road with Junkyard and Bang Tango and LA Guns and Tora Tora, and then you were lucky if you got to tour with The Cult and Judas Priest and Alice Cooper and Motorhead, and you can die a happy man because you got to do it your way. You were lucky enough to be invited. And someone thought that you were good enough or trendy enough at a time where, you know, I have long red hair and tattoos and I sing high, thank you, Axl Rose, for creating that for a lot of other bands. And, you know, as soon as they found a gold mine in Guns N' Roses, all the labels wanted to find their own Guns N' Roses. And that's just how that shit works. All the labels wanted a Pearl Jam after Pearl Jam blew up. You know, that whole kind of vocal, the Eddie Vedder thing. Man, that was rampant. Let's sign another person that sings like that. You know, it's the same fucking thing. So, but that falls by the wayside when you think about the memories you're creating and the respect that you're garnering just by being true to yourself. So that's great that people have mentioned, you know, my band or any you know, the Toys, you know, because Toys would be in the ilk of per people you're talking about, it would be the Toys that they're talking about. So yeah, that's great.
How about any you know, favorite stories or moments on the road back in the day, and then, or funny stories or anything you can share that kind of, you know, highlights that's a really good story. Yeah. That we could get.
Yeah. Lemmy in our dressing room. I think we were in Pittsburgh. Lemmy wearing Daisy Dukes. And nothing else. No, he might've been wearing flip flops. I don't know. But nothing else. Daisy Dukes, like short shorts, not just, you know, shorts, but fucking cutoffs, you know, jean Daisy Dukes, walks into our dressing room and he's just hanging out, being friendly. He's got a little whiskey with him and Wurzel's in tow. Wurzel's wearing what he wore on stage and they're drinking and they came in and we're getting ready to go on, you know? And we're all kind of dressed to go already. And it's still early. I mean, you know, we were going on in the daylight sometimes because it was a festival type situation. And it was that Operation Rock and Roll is what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So this would have been summer 91. And Lemmy's in the dressing room. And he picks up Danny's guitar and he starts playing songs. And Danny breaks out his harmonica and there's a little jam and they're jamming. And I say, "Hey, let me play Leaving Here." He's like, "Oh, the Birds. Oh yeah. Okay. All right." You know, he's playing a little song that I requested. And I'm thinking the video camera is on. I have this on video.
Oh, so, shit.
And you know, Lemmy and Daisy Dukes, I have with Danny's guitar sitting on a couch in the dressing room and, you know, Pennsylvania somewhere, and we're all kind of beating on the road case, you know, playing air drums and hanging out with Lemmy, singing Leaving Here by the Birds, and I guess it might be the Yardbirds, I don't know, some old dude's song, you know, but I love Leaving Here, but I love the Motorhead version, and I'm guilty of knowing that that's the only version I'll ever like, so, you know, little things like that. Just little things like that.
That's so cool.
We'll never go away.
Yeah.
Ever.
Oh man, please share that video. That sounds just amazing. Yeah, that's awesome.
I don't the thing is that's I don't know if I want to share that.
You know what I mean? I understand. Yeah. It's kind of your own personal.
Kind of a weird moment now that Lemmy's gone. It's kind of
an
emotional moment. Yeah.
Yeah, Lemmy, and there's been a lot of people the last couple of years. I mean, obviously Lemmy and, you know, Fast Eddie Clark here recently, Malcolm Young, and,
yeah,
you know, Tom Petty, Greg Allman. Like, it's been so many last couple of years, people.
Yeah.
Do you have any memories or thoughts of anybody? I mean, even if you knew them or you didn't know them or just their music you admired, is there anybody that you kind of have some thoughts or stories of besides that incredible one with Lemmy?
No. No, not really. I mean, we're, you know, the idols of a certain age group, we're actually losing them quite fast now. You know, the last couple of years have not been very good as far as the rock and roll legends and, you know, I think that just it kind of comes with the territory of reaching into your long in the tooth years, you know. And, you know, you can't stop what's coming. But the memories that I have with Lemmy and, you know, I never got to meet Malcolm or David Bowie or Chris Cornell. Stood in the same room with Chris Cornell once, but that's not much of a memory or a story. You know, it's pretty, it's when you love rock and roll as much as we do, it's, it hits home, you know, kind of emotional, and you do the best you can with it. But this sounds, you know, a bit like out of place for us to say things like what I'm about to say. But don't you, just through their music, don't you feel like you kind of knew them? Even though
yes.
We didn't, they could have been a fucking asshole. We wouldn't even know it. We don't fucking know. We don't fucking know David Bowie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you feel like you feel like you know him.
Oh, no question.
Because when was there a time in your life when there was not this guy named David Bowie like crooning to you all the time?
Yeah.
Never. Well, you know what? That's not going to change. He's always going to be crooning to you.
Yeah, I mean, growing
that's
up.
That's what I love about music. It's like, if you remember the first time you heard one of your favorite songs, that moment never goes away. That's an old friend. Even if you don't hear the song 10, 20, 30 years, and all of a sudden it comes on, oh man, I haven't heard this in so long, and you know all the words. You know what the room smelled like 30 years ago. It's all like part of your olfactory sense. This is all related to the reason why I am obsessed with rock and roll, because of the story I just told.
That's so true. I mean, I don't think since his passing in 2011, there's been a day that I haven't thought about Janie Lane, because I was 15 when their first album came out. And as he changed and his music changed and his things changed, I was maturing and changing too, right? And it just always spoke to me. And so, you know, I did feel like I knew him. So that type of loss is very personal, you know?
Yeah, whether you did or not, but it takes a part of you feels like it goes away when you have to step back and say, well, you know, he wasn't my brother, but I was related to him by way of, you know, that's 6 degrees of separation. Like, his music is my soundtrack. So,
yeah, for sure.
I walk down the street, or I'm driving in the car, and I'm not listening to anything. There's no radio. There's no CD. There's no iPod. There's no nothing. I still hear his music. That's you.
Yeah.
Yep. No question. No question. Yeah. That's awesome. That's a great way. Very. It's almost a lyrical way to put it. It's almost like, you know, you could write lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to do this, but I got to let you guys go.
Oh,
I've been
that's
on
awesome.
Here over an hour. I got, yeah. You know, I know you may not believe me or not, but I got shit to do.
Oh, no. We figured that the reason that it was 8 in the morning was because you were probably...
That's why. That's why we're doing this at the butthole hour. You know? So.
No, that's you being awesome. Thanks for the stories and the insights. This has been one of our favorite interviews. I think we're ready to say learned a lot, and thank you very much for your time, Jason. We have a little tradition on We Talk Music, the We Talk Podcast Network, where at the end here we give the person on the other end their chance to do a little segment we like to call Plug Your Shit.
Okay.
So,
On Prosthetic Records, the new Howling Sycamore, if you like interesting space travel through hard, heavy music, I can describe this as, and I like Queensryche, but I'm not the biggest fan in the world. I like the early Queensryche, but I feel like if I call Howling Sycamore, don't please no one kill me for saying this, but death metal Queensryche.
All right.
You know what I mean? It's melodic, but it's also very dark and scary and blast beats everywhere. So it's got this completely crushing vibe to it. But the vocals are very melodic and very over the top, a la old Jeff Tate kind of a vibe. Just angrier. And then, I'm working on a new Evil United record. The latest Broken Teeth record is called Four on the Floor. It's been out for a little while. The new Igniter record is called Haunted by Rock and Roll, and that's in stores now, soon to be coming out on vinyl. And, Dangerous Toys is going to be on the Monsters of Rock cruise here in a couple of weeks. And who knows, more of the same from myself in the future.
Well, we're going to buy a copy of Pissed from vinyl ourselves.
There you go.
So there you go.
But yeah. I got to say that the new Igniter album and the new Broken Teeth album, both excellent. I truly enjoyed them. So I want everybody to go out and buy those.
Yeah, those are a lot of fun, those records. A lot of fun. Yeah.
Thank you.
And well, Jason McMaster, yeah.
Yeah, hopefully we're hoping you'll be on Monsters of Rock Cruise the next year, too, because we're hoping to get to that one ourselves.
Yeah, I hope so, too. And I hope Dangerous Toys can have the folly of becoming just busier as we go gray.
Awesome.
Well, we wish you all the best, and thank you so much for your time.
Of course.
Awesome.
Have a good day.
Yeah, we'll do. You too.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now.